Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're going straight into something that, well, it affects all of us living in American cities, especially right here in Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena.
Absolutely. We're talking about how our cities are financed and how these big development trends are really shaping our communities.
Yeah, and we've got a really insightful discussion to unpack. It comes from a forum at the Dole Institute of Politics. Mm-hmm. And our guides for this are basically excerpts from a video. We've got Whitney Alfonso. She's an expert on state and local public finance from UNC Chapel Hill.
Right.
And Dennis Strait, who's an architect and landscape architect, lots of experience in urban planning.
And what's really crucial here, I think, for listeners to grasp right off the bat is the financial engine, you know, what keeps our cities actually running.
Exactly. The revenue streams, the pressures they're under.
And where things might be heading, especially for folks in Southeast Houston. Understanding these, let's call them financial underpinnings, it's key. Key to seeing the opportunities and, frankly, the challenges in your own neighborhoods.
And figuring out how you can maybe get involved, shape that future.
Precisely.
Okay, so let's get into the nuts and bolts. How do cities actually make money? Whitney laid out the common sources, you know, before the pandemic just turned everything upside down.
Yeah, the pre-pandemic baseline.
She said property taxes. That's traditionally been the big one, right? The main pillar.
Historically, yes. That's been the most stable kind of foundational source for funding local services. Police, fire, schools, roads. Mostly funded that way.
But it's interesting. She also mentioned sales taxes becoming more important.
Definitely. A growing trend. Though it's worth noting, not every city or county can levy a sales tax. State laws vary quite a bit on that.
Right. So where they do have it, it's a bigger piece of the pie now.
It is. But it also introduces a different kind of dynamic. Sales tax revenue goes up and down with the economy, with consumer spending. It's less predictable than property tax.
Makes sense. And it's not just those two, is it? Cities also get money from, like, fines and fees.
Oh, yeah. Parking tickets, permits, that sort of thing. And in some places, occupancy taxes are significant.
That's the hotel tax, right?
Exactly. Tourists and business travelers contribute through that. And then you have a few places, like in Ohio or New York City, that even have local income taxes.
Wow. So it really is a mix, kind of a patchwork, depending on where you are.
It is. Yeah. And that mix really affects a city's financial health, its resilience, when, you know, the economy takes a downturn.
We certainly saw that recently. Okay, so that's revenue. Where's the money going? What are the big spending categories?
Well, Whitney pointed out some pretty consistent ones across the board. The biggest usually is personnel.
Salaries, benefits for city employees.
Yep. That tends to be the largest slice of the operating budget. No real surprise there.
Okay. What else?
Infrastructure is huge, but that's often handled a bit differently, more through capital budgets.
Mm-hmm.
Think big projects, road construction, water main replacements.
Stuff that costs a lot up front.
Exactly. And then pensions for retired public workers. That's another substantial and often growing expense.
Yeah, you hear a lot about pension liabilities.
And of course, public safety, police, and fire departments, always a major cost center.
But it feels like cities are being asked to do more now than just, you know, the basics.
That's a really critical point, something Dennis Strait emphasized too.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just about filling potholes and collecting trash anymore.
Right.
There's this growing expectation, especially relevant for places like Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena, for cities to invest in things like affordable housing.
Living wage policies, equity initiatives.
Greenways, bike paths, better public transportation. It's a much broader mandate than it used to be.
And all those things cost money, adding pressure to the budget.
Absolutely. Which ties into this really thought-provoking idea from Dennis Strait. He basically challenges the whole way we've built cities since the 1950s.
The suburban growth model driven by cars?
Exactly. Mm. He argues it's not just a different lifestyle. It's a fundamentally new and potentially unsustainable way of organizing ourselves.
How so? What's the core problem he sees?
Well, think about how cities worked for centuries. People had to live relatively close together. Close to shops, jobs, amenities. Proximity was key.
Because you walked or maybe had a horse or a streetcar.
Right. Then comes the widespread adoption of the automobile. Suddenly, distance isn't the same barrier. You can live further out.
And that leads to sprawl. The kind of landscape many of us live in now, right? In Southeast Houston and elsewhere.
Precisely. But Strait says this shift has created some serious long-term financial headaches.
Okay, explain that. What are the headaches?
It comes down to infrastructure lifespans. He uses streets as an example. Maybe they last about 50 years, give or take.
Okay.
Well, think about it. A huge amount of that post-1950s suburban infrastructure the roads, the pipes, everything is now hitting that 50, 60, 70 year mark.
Ah, so it's all starting to wear out around the same time.
You got it. Which means communities, including many around Houston, are facing this massive wave of necessary and very expensive reinvestment.
And here's the kicker, I assume.
The kicker is, Strait argues, this low density, spread out model requires way more infrastructure per person or per house, more miles of roads, pipes, wires.
Compared to a more compact city.
Right. But it doesn't generate enough tax revenue, particularly property tax revenue, from that spread out land to actually pay for the long-term maintenance and replacement of all that infrastructure.
So it's like digging a financial hole.
That's exactly how he describes it, a growing financial hole. And you see the effects, don't you? The condition of local roads, maybe water main breaks. That's often the visible result.
Yeah, you definitely notice aging infrastructure.
And Whitney Alfonso added another layer here. She talked about the 1970s, which saw not just more reliance on sales taxes, but also the rise of tax and expenditure limits.
Caps on how much cities could tax or spend.
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah.
So while revenue tools were changing, sometimes being restricted, the demands on cities, the responsibilities were actually increasing, like we just talked about.
So more responsibilities, sometimes tighter revenue constraints, and aging infrastructure from sprawl. That's a tough combination.
It's a perfect storm, financially speaking, for many places.
This leads right into that idea of the urban core versus the suburbs. Dennis Strait's point is that traditionally, the dense city center was the economic engine, right?
Yeah. Historically, that's where the highest concentration of economic activity was. Businesses, jobs, generating more tax revenue per square foot or per acre than lower density areas.
Makes sense. More value packed into a smaller space.
And Strait argues that the current balance, vast amounts of this less revenue productive suburban land compared to the relatively smaller, highly productive urban core, is kind of historically weird. It's out of whack.
This type of sprawl is a pretty recent invention in the grand scheme of city building.
Relatively speaking, yes. And his key assertion, which is pretty provocative, is that suburban living, because of those high infrastructure demands, is often implicitly subsidized.
Subsidized? How?
Because the property taxes generated in many low-density suburbs often don't actually cover the full long-term cost of providing and maintaining the roads, water, sewer, schools, everything needed out there.
So the denser parts of the region, or maybe state and federal funds, are indirectly picking up the slack.
That's the implication of his analysis. The math often doesn't add up locally.
And he pointed out that even supposedly wealthy suburbs aren't immune. They can get hit hard when growth slows down.
Right. He mentioned the downturn about a decade ago. When development stalled, even affluent suburbs suddenly had to make cuts to public services because that continuous growth model is fragile.
It relies on constantly expanding, constantly building.
When that music stops, the underlying financial strains become really clear.
Okay, let's talk about those new demands on cities. Whitney mentioned things like bike lanes, greenways.
Yeah, these newer amenities that people increasingly want, which is great. It reflects changing values, desire for recreation, sustainability.
But it adds another layer of cost onto the traditional stuff, roads, water, power.
It absolutely does.
Yeah.
Cities are expected to maintain the old and build the new.
And Dennis Strait had that interesting point about why we need separate bike lanes so often.
Oh, yeah. The street design issue. Because we design so many streets primarily, almost exclusively, for cars.
They're just not safe for walking or biking.
Exactly. So now we have to come back and build separate infrastructure, like dedicated bike lanes or side paths, to make it safe for other users.
Yeah.
It's like compensating for past design choices.
Whereas older streets maybe handled different modes more naturally.
Often, yes. Before the car completely dominated planning, streets were more multifunctional by necessity.
He also connected sprawl to affordable housing challenges. How did that work?
Through zoning. He argued that modern zoning practices, which often rigidly separate land, uses residential here, commercial there, single-family homes only in this zone.
That's a relatively new thing.
Compared to historical patterns, yes.
Yeah.
Older neighborhoods, he said, often had a much greater mix of apartments above shops, different house sizes on the same block, a wider range of price points integrated together.
And modern zoning prevents that mix.
It often does. By mandating large lots or prohibiting multifamily housing in certain areas, it effectively limits the supply of smaller, potentially more affordable housing options. It creates less diversity.
Okay, that makes sense. This brings us to density and downtown revitalization. Lots of cities try to boost their downtowns, right? Increase density there.
Yeah, it's a common strategy. Thinkers like Richard Florida popularized the idea that a vibrant, dense downtown acts as an economic catalyst.
We heard the Kansas City example. Their downtown population grew, and it seemed to help the city's economy overall.
The logic is sound on the surface. Concentrate activity, attract businesses, generate more tax revenue efficiently from that core area. Make better use of existing infrastructure, too.
But there was a question raised, wasn't there, about the cost versus the benefit?
Yes, that's the critical question. These downtown revitalization efforts often involve significant public investment tax incentives for developers, infrastructure upgrades, new parks, maybe a streetcar.
Does that investment always pay off for the city's general fund? Does the increased activity generate enough new revenue to justify the cost?
It's not always clear. It requires really careful analysis. While a buzzing downtown looks great, you have to ask if it's truly strengthening the city's overall financial position or mainly benefiting specific developers or downtown residents.
And there's that churn, too. Whitney mentioned younger people might move downtown.
Right, for the lifestyle, the excitement.
But then they start families and often move out to the suburbs.
Meaning cities constantly need to attract new waves of young professionals or maybe empty nesters to keep that downtown vibrancy going. It's an ongoing effort.
That's not necessarily a one-time fix.
Definitely not. It requires sustained effort and investment.
This all comes back to how cities compete. Whitney mentioned the cost of living issue. It's often just more expensive inside the city limits, right? Housing, taxes.
Yeah, that's a major factor. People compare housing costs, property taxes, maybe school quality, and the suburbs often look more appealing on a spreadsheet, at least initially.
Even if, as Strait argues, the long-term costs of suburban infrastructure aren't fully factored in by the homeowner.
Exactly. Perception versus long-term reality.
And she brought up the property tax issue again. People commute in, use city services, wear out city roads, but if they live outside the city,
they aren't paying city property taxes, so they benefit from the services without contributing through that main revenue source.
That free rider problem, essentially.
Which is why cities often look to things like sales taxes or occupancy taxes.
Yeah.
Those do capture revenue from non-residents, from commuters buying lunch or tourists staying in hotels.
But those can be politically difficult to implement or raise, as Whitney noted.
Very much so, especially if surrounding jurisdictions don't see a direct benefit to themselves.
Like that failed transportation sales tax in Atlanta she mentioned. Getting regional cooperation on funding is tough.
Extremely tough. Everyone wants the benefits of regional infrastructure, but agreeing on who pays and how much, that's a huge political challenge. Differing priorities, local politics, it often stalls regional solutions.
Okay, let's shift slightly to how cities spend. Whitney explained the difference between operating budgets and capital budgets.
Right. Operating is the day-to-day stuff. Salaries, pensions, supplies, utilities, usually funded by current revenues like taxes and fees.
And capital is the big long-term stuff, infrastructure.
Exactly. Roads, buildings, major equipment. Those are typically funded through borrowing, issuing bonds, taking on debt, separate pot of money, managed differently.
Understanding that split is important. They aren't just dipping into the same bucket for salaries and road paving.
Generally not, no. Though sometimes financial stress can blur those lines or lead to underinvestment in capital projects to protect the operating budget.
And she also flagged those pension obligations again. Big, sometimes underfunded liabilities.
Yes, that's a major shadow hanging over many city budgets. Promises made years ago that require significant funding today and tomorrow. If those aren't managed well, they can crowd out funding for other services.
There was also a suggestion, maybe related to personnel costs, that older, larger cities might just be less efficient than newer suburbs.
The idea was floated, yeah. That perhaps older cities have accumulated more layers of administration, more legacy costs, higher personnel expenses per capita compared to leaner, newer suburban governments.
Is that fair, do you think?
It's complex. Older cities often provide a wider range of services, deal with more complex social issues, and have older infrastructure needing more maintenance. But it's certainly an area where efficiency is always being scrutinized.
Dennis Strait tied this back to the age thing. Older cities like Kansas City might just have been following these less sustainable sprawl patterns for longer.
Right, so they might have deeper infrastructure deficits, more entrenched financial habits that are harder to change compared to a suburb built mostly in the last 30 years. History matters.
And that history dramatically affects public transit too. Dennis's point about old Kansas City.
Fascinating comparison. Pre-1950s, much denser population packed into a smaller area.
And an extensive private streetcar system serving that dense population.
Exactly. Density makes transit viable, even profitable potentially. Lots of people close together means lots of potential riders for every mile of track or bus route.
Contrast that with today. Kansas City, Missouri, the city itself, has a much lower population density, even though its land area ballooned outwards.
Yeah, the population spread way out. And that makes providing good, frequent, affordable public transit incredibly challenging.
Why? Just the distances involved?
Distances, yes, but also the low number of people living or working near any given stop. You need massive scale, huge subsidies to make traditional transit work well in a very low density environment. It's just geometry and economics.
So those modern transit projects, like the KC streetcar we mentioned,
often they're focused on revitalizing a specific corridor, usually the downtown or a dense node. They can be great for that area.
But they don't necessarily solve the transportation problem for the majority of people living in the wider, sprawling region.
That's often the critique. And then you get into questions about who benefits most and who pays. Is it serving essential commuting needs, or is it more about tourism and downtown development, subsidized by all taxpayers?
Right, that free ridership question again, in a different context.
Tough questions about priorities and effectiveness.
Okay, we absolutely have to talk about COVID-19. Whitney described the impact on city finances as unprecedented uncertainty.
Totally unprecedented. Cities make budgets based on forecasts, predictions of revenue. Suddenly, bam, the economy slams shut. All those forecasts were just out the window.
A massive shock to the system.
Huge. And immediate.
She noted property taxes held up okay, relatively speaking. They're less volatile.
Yeah, property assessments don't change overnight. But other key revenues.
Sales taxes, occupancy taxes.
Plummeted. Especially early on. Yeah. Think about restaurants, shops, hotels closing, or having drastically reduced business. Utility revenue sometimes dropped too as businesses closed.
And she saw a difference in the recovery speed, right? Yeah. Between big cities and smaller places.
Yeah, that was interesting. Rural and mid-sized cities, their sales tax often bounced back quicker. Maybe because people were staying local, shopping local.
Whereas the big urban centers,
they suffered longer. Why? Because they rely so much more on business travel, on daily commuters coming downtown, on tourism. Mm-hmm. All of that just cratered and took much longer to recover.
Makes sense. So how did cities cope with these huge, sudden shortfalls?
First stop usually is reserve funds, those rainy day funds cities are supposed to keep.
Tapping into savings.
Exactly. But those only last so long. Then came the cuts. Hiring freezes were common, furloughs for existing staff, pausing capital projects, infrastructure work.
Delaying the inevitable in some cases.
Pretty much. And lurking behind all this was the worry about long-term changes. Will remote work become permanent for a large chunk of the workforce?
What does that mean for downtown office buildings, for restaurants that relied on office workers, for transit systems?
Big, big questions. It could fundamentally alter how cities function and how they're financed if those patterns shift permanently.
So looking ahead, what's the future hold? Whitney suggested cities might need a serious rethink.
Yeah, rethink how urban space is used, especially if business travel and daily commuting patterns really do change for good.
She saw potential opportunity too, right? For more affordable cities.
Possibly.
Mm-hmm.
If remote work takes hold, maybe people will choose to live in smaller or mid-sized cities that offer a good quality of life and amenities, but without the super high costs of the biggest metro areas.
And Dennis saw the pandemic as a wake-up call.
A harsh one. Highlighting those financial vulnerabilities we've been talking about, the fragility of the sprawl model, and just reinforcing the need for more sustainable growth.
He mentioned self-driving cars briefly. Disruptive, but maybe good in the long run.
The impact is still really uncertain. Could it reduce the need for parking, make streets safer, free up space currently dedicated to cars? Maybe. Could it encourage even more sprawl because commutes become less burdensome? Also maybe.
Turi's still out on that one.
Very much so. But he did hold up Europe as a bit of a model.
Because they never went quite as all in on cars.
Exactly. Many European cities retained more density, more mixed-use development, and invested more consistently in walking, cycling, and public transit infrastructure. Their streets are often designed for multiple modes, not just the car.
Lessons we could learn here.
Definitely. Creating more human-centered, multimodal, and ultimately more sustainable urban environments. The pandemic might actually push us faster in that direction.
But the recovery itself, financially, will take time.
Oh, yeah. Both Whitney and Dennis agreed on that. It's likely a multi-year process for city finances to fully recover, requiring really careful management and smart planning.
Okay, so wrapping this all up, this deep dive really showed us, I think, the foundations of city finance, that historical reliance on property tax, the growing role and volatility of sales tax.
And the huge impact of that post-World War II suburban development pattern, the infrastructure burden it created.
Right. And layered on top of that, all the new things cities are expected to do now. Affordable housing, greenways, transit, equity.
While dealing with legacy costs like pensions. And then, of course, the massive ongoing disruption from COVID-19.
It's a complex picture. And for our listeners in Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena, understanding these big trends really gives context, doesn't it, for local debates about a new development or road funding or what services the city should prioritize?
Absolutely. It helps you see how your local situation fits into these larger national patterns and challenges.
Right.
It prompts you to ask, how are these dynamics playing out right here?
It certainly raises important questions about the long-term sustainability and vibrancy of our own communities.
It really does.
And on that note, here's a final thought, especially for everyone listening in Southeast Houston.
Yeah.
Given all these pressures, the financial constraints, the changing needs, what kind of innovative, maybe creative, forward-thinking approaches could residents in Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena explore?
Yeah, what can be done locally?
To ensure your communities remain vital and sustainable for the long haul, maybe it involves getting more engaged in local planning, thinking critically about the type of development that truly serves the community and the region's future.
That's a powerful call to action. Local engagement really can shape the future.
Well, this has been a deep dive into municipal finance and urban development. If you found this valuable, if you want to support more discussions like this that aim to empower you, the residents, to understand and act on local issues right here,
please consider supporting the work.
You can visit thinkandactlocally.com/donate. We'll put that link in the show notes. Thanks for tuning in.